This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices. You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable. Since 1988, Whitetail Institute has been perfecting annual and perennial seed products specifically for hunters who plant food plots. Their seeds have been engineered to be palatable, high in protein, and extremely attractive to deer. Whether you live in the Deep South or Midwest farm country, they have products that will help you grow your best food plot yet. For more information about their seeds and their blends, visit whitetailinstitute.com. Enter the discount code SE15 for 15% off.
We're leaving today and entering a world of Mickey Mouse waving, princess meeting and greeting, lightsaber clashing, the Twilight Zone Tower of Terror dropping, banshee flying, Space Mountain launching, galaxy rewinding, what's the whole deck with galaxy rewinding, fireworks igniting, world of other worlds. For whatever you love, infinite worlds await at the most magical place on Earth, Walt Disney World Resort.
Sierra has all the best active and outdoor brands you need, from athletic stuff, like a full-court pickup game, swish, to athletic-ish stuff, like a half-mile stroll. Get those steps in! And for morning hikes up the mountain trail, good pace, to nighttime ghost stories from the camping chair. What a twist! Whatever level of active, Sierra loves it all. Head to Sierra or Sierra.com for the brands you want at the prices that let you do it all. From athletic to athletic-ish, Sierra's got it.
Two Good & Co. coffee creamers are made with farm-fresh cream, real milk, and contain 3 grams of sugar per serving. That's 40% less than the 5 grams per serving in leading traditional coffee creamers for a rich, delicious experience. Whether you enjoy your coffee hot, cold, bold, or frothy, Two Good coffee creamers make every sip a good one. Two Good coffee creamers, real goodness in every sip. Find them at your local Kroger in the creamer aisle.
When it's time to go after the biggest buck of your life, you need gear that will not only make your life easier, but that you can also depend on for years to come. Lone Wolf Custom Gear has been the leader in mobile hunting equipment for over 40 years and started out right here in Wisconsin. From inventing the climbing stick to perfecting ultralight tree stands, Lone Wolf Custom Gear continues to innovate and put the best mobile hunting equipment on the market with a ton of fantastic accessories that allow you to customize your gear exactly how you want it. Whether it be the high-end DeQuisto series sticks and stands or the affordable Patriot series, you'll have the peace of mind knowing that you're hanging off of gear that was 100% made in the USA, right here in the Midwest, in fact, and has been designed and perfected by some of the best whitetail hunters in the world. Not to mention, it has an unconditional lifetime warranty that's so good your grandkids and even great-grandkids will be able to use it when they're hunting. Go build your kit out today at lonewolfcustomgear.com. Prime time for hitting the woods, and when you do, you need to know where you're going, and the best tool for the job is the Onyx Hunt app, which just keeps getting better and better. I've used Onyx for almost a decade now, and it's far and away my most used hunting tool. From making sure you're within a property boundary to peeling back the layers of an area with leaf-off imagery, the Onyx Hunt app will help you understand a property quicker than anything. As we head into the peak season, I've been using the LiDAR feature in the Topo base map to spot areas that will funnel deer through a specific location, and the slope angle exposure layer to get an idea of how much sunlight reaches an area and predict how my thermals will behave. To try it out for yourself and have more success this fall, go visit onxmaps.com/hunt. Fall is here and it's time to get out in the woods, and when you do, you need gear that's going to keep you warm, dry, and concealed while you're pursuing wild game. That's why I'm proud to be partners with Huntworth Gear, the makers of badass, affordable hunting gear that's readily available and won't break the bank. You've heard me talk about this gear for years now, and for good reason. Their Heat Boost gear is the warmest hunting gear I've ever worn, and guys, I promise you, I'm not just saying that. It beats the heck out of traditional merino, fleece, or down hunting clothes. Not to mention, we've got a ton of great new camo patterns, including our new waterfowl pattern, Oberus, which has been expertly designed to keep you concealed from wary ducks flying overhead. To go get kitted out for this fall, visit huntworthgear.com or head on over to the sporting goods section of your local Farm and Fleet or Fleet Farm to check it out in person. Southwest Wisconsin is home to one of the most unique trout fisheries in the country, with thousands of miles of spring-fed streams twisting their way through valleys, pastures, and prairies, and one of the best ways to experience this fishery is with a fly rod in hand. Good Chance Fly Fishing is your guide to all that the Driftless has to offer, whether you're an experienced angler or you're just looking to try something new and get into fly fishing. To find more info and book your trip, visit goodchanceflyfishing.com. If you've listened to this show before, I'm sure you've noticed that if there's one thing that keeps coming up over and over again, it's the importance of public lands and waters. Shoot, I'd venture to guess that 90% of what we talk about on this show takes place on public lands. We all love the challenges we face and the memories we create in these wild places, and we need folks who are in our corner to protect them as well. That's why we're proud to have partnered with the good folks over at the Wisconsin Chapter of Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. The Wisconsin BHA Chapter was formed to provide a voice for hunters and anglers throughout Wisconsin that want to protect our public land legacy, and everyone involved worked their tails off to protect public lands and access to those public lands and waters. To stay informed on all things public lands, the issues facing our public lands, policies that might affect them, and to cross paths with some of the coolest outdoorsmen out there, I highly encourage you to join the Wisconsin Chapter of Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, or at least the chapter of whatever state you live in. Also, be on the lookout for our Wisconsin Public Land Policy bonus episodes to keep you all in the loop on the legal side of conservation and how things get done here in Wisconsin. To join BHA, visit backcountryhunters.org/join, and to learn more about what's going on here in the Badger State, visit backcountryhunters.org/Wisconsin. What is going on, everyone? Welcome back to another episode of the Wisconsin Sportsman Podcast, which is brought to you by Lone Wolf Custom Gear. I'm your host, Pierce Nellis, and this is your home for all things hunting, fishing, and conservation in the Badger State. Folks, I hope you're all doing well. I hope Rutcation has been treating you nicely. And I hope that if you haven't punched a tag, that some luck comes your way very quickly. As I record this, I just got done quartering out, cutting up, boning out, and prepping for butcher a nice buck that I happened to shoot last night. Found him this morning after I'm not going to give too many details. Basically, I shot him, I bumped him, and had to wait till this morning. And I'm going to leave it at that, because next week you'll get to hear the full story of probably one of the craziest days of whitetail hunting I've ever had in my life. And also just one of the most fun. Saw more cool shit and just awesome stuff than I really think I have in any day whitetail hunting. So I'm just going to leave it at that. Sorry for the teaser. I'm stoked. I'm scatterbrained. I've been up since the wee hours of the morning. Didn't sleep hardly at all last night. Just worrying about this deer. But hey, tag is punched, an arrow is bloody, and the freezer is getting filled. So I'm freaking stoked. But I wasn't stoked earlier this week. Actually, prior to the last 24 hours, I was having a real rough time. Because November's crazy, right? It's the month that we all look forward to throughout the entire year, because anything can happen. But when it's not happening, it really has the potential to suck at the same time, right? And that can wear on you. The days are long. The early mornings, you know, wear you out. Your back is sore from sitting on a tree the entire day. And it's just, it's a grind, right? And a lot of times that's what it takes to punch tags this time of year. As fun as it is, depending on what your goals are for the season, November can be a really challenging time just purely due to the randomness of it. But there are tactics that you can deploy and things that you can do to put the odds in your favor. And so I wanted to bring in a guy who directly influenced my recent success, as you'll hear in this episode. But I wanted to talk to Greg Kazmierski. Now, Greg is part of the Whitetail Partners team. He is the owner of Next Level Whitetail, is his business. But he works with Sam Billhorn, who's been on the show, as well as Josh Raley. He's part of the Whitetail Partners conglomerate. And he is an absolute genius when it comes to breaking down terrain, predicting deer movement, interpreting trail camera data, and just getting on and killing big deer. And so I wanted to bring him in mainly because I'm sure if you follow this guy on social media, you've probably seen and learned a ton from his social media content. He does a really, really awesome job of breaking down terrain and breaking down specific real world examples of where does are bedding, how he's planning access, what wind is doing, how to like predict thermals and stuff like that. Just stuff that's like, if you're a visual learner, you can gain a ton from his content and from his knowledge. And so I wanted to have him on. The two of us had a fantastic conversation about terrain features he likes, you know, the importance of scouting this time of year, and really just how to put yourself in position to have success in this second, you know, I guess we'll call it the mid-November time frame in the whitetail woods. So we talk about that kind of stuff, talk about the importance of just staying positive and hanging in there, having a little bit of mental toughness, accepting that it is going to be a grind. And I think acknowledging that is especially important, that, you know, as like I said, as fun as this is, like there's a lot of it that's not fun. You know, we endure a lot of stuff that isn't fun for that flurry of activity, for that magic 5 minute window or sometimes 30 second window that gives us our opportunity for the season, for us to get our pins settled and let that arrow fly and hopefully, you know, have a grip and grin to show at the end of it. So it's a fantastic episode. A couple things I want to plug though. I mentioned Greg's social media is phenomenal. So if you're on Instagram or Facebook, definitely check out his Instagram handle is Greg_NextLevelWhitetail. You will learn so freaking much. And if you want to go over to YouTube, the Next Level Whitetail YouTube channel of his is also just absolutely fantastic. He's got a video series specifically on types of rut funnels and how to hunt them that actually just came out. And so I'm going to plug that in the show notes. So be sure to check those out, regardless of if you're sitting in the stand. Say that with a little caveat there. You know, be on your toes. You know, keep no earbuds. Be listening, because anything can happen. But if you're trying to figure stuff out at deer camp in the evenings, I'll put it that way. Yeah, do it in the evening, or maybe when you're taking your lunch break or something like that. Check his stuff out because it's absolutely fantastic. Can't thank Greg enough for taking time, especially out of his rut hunting, to hop on the phone and do a little episode with me. But I really think you guys are going to enjoy this one. Good luck to everybody who's still out there trying to punch a tag. I've still got one more that I'm looking to punch, and I'm just fired up right now, but I'm stoked. And you know, everything after this is icing on the cake. So I'm just stoked to have my second bow buck ever on the ground, which you guys will hear about next week. But big thanks to Greg. Thanks to all you guys for listening, and we'll talk to you next Tuesday. Good luck out there, guys. All right, joining me on this week's episode of the Wisconsin Sportsman, I have Greg Kazmierski with Next Level Whitetail. Greg, how are we doing today?
Good, man. How are you doing?
Excellent. Excellent. We are in between rut sits as we record this right now on November 3rd. So I appreciate you skipping over the midday sit and taking a break to hop on and record with me, man.
Yeah, looking absolutely forward to it. Happy to be here.
Yeah. How has the season been for you so far?
Overall, the season's been good. This is the first full season that I have on my property that I bought here in Ohio.
And oh, awesome.
I didn't have a ton of time to work on my own property this winter with how busy I was with work. So I was able to do a few improvements that I thought were going to make my property really good during this time of the year. And it did set up that way. And thankfully, I had an opportunity. The one setup in particular that I thought was going to be the best one on my property, didn't really touch it until this end of October, and then went in there and everything happened the way it was supposed to. It's just, unfortunately, when I shot at the best buck that's been hanging out on the property, he ducked and I shot a little high and just gave him a haircut, and that was that. Dang. So everything worked out except the shot.
Yeah. Shoot, man. Well, has he resurfaced at all?
Has he been on camera? Back around chasing some does. The way that my property is right now, like I said, I didn't have a ton of time to get everything done. So there's not a great amount of bedding on there for this time of the year. So they kind of just pass through whenever they're visiting the food plot or the acorns that I have on the property, and then they'll slip off to the neighboring properties for a couple of days, and they just kind of work their way back and forth right now.
Okay. Gotcha. Makes sense. So being that it's your first year with this property, you said you've done a couple of little, you know, habitat improvements and stuff. What was like the top priority, for somebody? Like, cause I can't imagine, you know, you're the only person who's on a new property trying to figure it out. I mean, we're just talking off air. I'm doing the same thing. I'm not doing any habitat work yet, but also trying to learn a new property. What were the priorities for you in setting up this property?
Yeah. So priority number one was just really getting a good understanding of how exactly the deer are using my property naturally. And my property is in very steep and rugged terrain. So that already narrows down the main areas that they're going to use. So on top of that, I focus a lot of my stand locations, but a lot of trail cameras around those. So I get a really good idea on where are the main entry exit points when they're coming onto my place, because I only have around 30 acres. So it's not like I'm getting deer to live on there consistently, but where are they coming in and out of, and where can I target my stand locations based off of that movement? So that way I'm not ever really walking into the core part of the property until the best time of the year, but I can still hunt it effectively from the outside edges. So that was my main thing here in year one. And then just the other thing was recognizing the obvious need that I'm in a big timber area. There's not a lot of green food sources. So I knew if I could get a food plot implemented, even if it wasn't in the best shape, that was going to be a good draw for deer. And it's proven to be that. It holds does, it gets does day and night, and I don't ever hunt it. And I hunt it very rarely, I should say. I think I've sat at once, maybe twice all season, but those does are in there routinely, spending a lot of time and very comfortable because there's no hunting pressure around it.
Mm-hmm. Got it. That makes sense, man. Yeah. I like that strategy a lot about, you know, trying to focus on the fringe rather than diving into the center, especially on areas where, I mean, this property that I've been hunting this year, it's 140, but it's only got like 26 acres of timber that's, you know, actually going to hold deer. I guess that, especially now that the corn's down for a while there, they were all over the place. I had no clue what was going on, but
I
like that strategy a lot of like, just not feeling like you need to get into that main spot or that main core area to.
Definitely. And I had a pretty good idea that that core part, I have this little point that transitions from the bedding habitat that does exist on my property to the oaks, and then my food plot on the other side of that point. And that point is right in the heart, but it's also the main transition zone. So I knew that if I could keep that undisturbed and just let the deer have that part of the property, I get cell phone service up there, I run a cell camera, and I'm just going to wait for them to tell me when it's time to go in, you know. And once that buck followed a doe through on my scrape location, I had a pretty good idea if I went up there the next day, he was going to come through, and it ended up happening. So I think there's something to be said about leaving your best stands for when you know they're going to be at their best. You're going to have much better hunts when you do go in there.
Yeah, definitely. So that's interesting just about the cell camera approach there and picking up on you once he showed the first time, you knew that you were going to go back and kind of made the playoff of that. This time of year, like, I guess, let me rewind here. Obviously, this is in hindsight. You know, that was, I'm assuming, a week or two ago, late October timeframe. Is that generally what you kind of make your first play on, is just sort of what your cameras are telling you? And like, okay, if this buck has shown once, he's likely to do it again? Or how do you build confidence in that next sit?
Yeah, so at least have me know that he's going to be in the area. Knowing that,
okay,
I have to take the factors of my property and understand that it's not a place that they're going to spend a lot of time. And what I've noticed from the trail cameras and from my hunts so far this fall on the property is that they usually come and they hang around for a day or so, and then they'll leave for 3 or 4 days and they'll come back. Because I found that deer in my area are just more nomadic. They don't really stick around in one spot. They're kind of bouncing around, especially on years like this where we just have a ton of acorns. So I was only wanting to really target that short window. And when he came through following that doe, I had a good feeling it was one of the does that probably hang out in my food plot. So knowing that, knowing she's going to be around, I knew there was a pretty good chance that he was going to come back. So like the day before, he hit that scrape at 9:30. So wind conditions were the same. So I knew, well, hey, if he's going to be in the area. Maybe I can catch him with a call at the right time, or maybe he's just going to go through. He lost track of that doe. It's never a guaranteed thing. You know, he hit it at 9:30 the night before, and I hope he comes in daylight, and it's not guaranteed, but I have enough of a good feeling that there's a chance that then it's good time for me to go in there because all the conditions are right and he's in the area, and I just need to get a little bit lucky then. And I did, just not when I actually took the shot, just when I saw him at bow range.
Yeah. Yeah, man. No, that makes sense. So conditions staying stable, does that play a huge or pretty good factor in making that decision? Like if he rolls through, I mean, this week, it's been like north, south, like flipping every single day.
Yeah.
Are you like, if that would have happened, you know, last week or whenever it was that you got that first picture, it was a south wind, the next day was a north wind, but the day after that was a south wind again, would you have waited for that south wind, or would you have stuck around, gone after it on the north wind?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think that the best way to answer that is that it's like one of those, it's situational type of an answer. My property, knowing that they only come through there every so often and they're on these cycles, I knew that I had a really short window. So honestly, regardless of what that wind was going to be, I was going to get in there and hunt. It was just, if my setup wasn't quite right because I had a different wind, that's where I'm going to take advantage of being mobile and getting into a different spot. Like I have a pre-hung set there, but if I need to get mobile, I have other trees prepped based off of the wind, because like I said, I know that ridge point is the spot. I can kind of narrow it down into bow range that they should funnel through here. It's just, how can I get set up so that way I have the wind advantage? And it just so happens that where my preset stand was hung, the wind for that was perfect 2 days in a row.
Nice. Got it. That makes sense. Yeah. Yeah. Definitely has the advantage of being mobile. And I'm glad that you brought that up. Just because, like we talked about off air, like a lot of guys are starting to transition to mobile hunting on private property.
Yeah.
And, you know, managing their property or hunting their properties in that manner. That's kind of a perfect segue, honestly, into, you know, not every spot sets up, you know, we try and design specific spots or pick out trees that are great for specific wind. We don't always have that. You know, ideally we have an area that, you know, our access is good for that wind to get into that tree. We're not going to blow our scent anywhere that we don't want it to go and everything. But then when we have to get in there and hunt it on a different wind and get mobile, when you get into that spot, how much are you changing? Are you changing your access entirely? Are you taking the same access and then potentially just crossing that trail and planning to shoot him when he crosses the trail? Or what's your headspace look like there?
Yeah. So with something like that, it's really going to depend on how exactly like that spot sets up orientation wise for where the deer should be traveling. So if we keep taking a deeper dive on this spot that I'm talking about, naturally their travel is going to be from the west to the east or the east to the west. And then they'll come in a little bit to the north and south, but that main traffic is west to east for this type of a setup. So if I have any type of a northerly wind, I have an access route plan. And then any type of a southerly wind, I come in from the other side and just hunt that transition zone in a little bit different area. But just keeping my biggest thing is I don't want to put my ground scent where I think they're going to walk. And then I want that north or south wind, whatever it is, to be blowing away from that main east to west travel that I'm anticipating. So two different access routes, depending on the wind. The one access route, in my case, the north wind, I have a preset stand for that. And then if it's a southerly wind, that's where I just get mobile in my saddle. And then I have a little bit different hunt. That's just more so like on the downwind side of the scrape location.
Okay, got it. That makes sense. Now, let me ask you this, because this is extremely relevant to a current property that I'm hunting here. Let's say you've got same sort of situation like you, east and west running ridge trail system and everything like that. But the north side of it is a sheer, not a sheer bluff, but pretty dang close to a a big steep drop off. Yep. Not impossible to get up the back of. Honestly, I think I may have just answered my question there. I'm just going to quit being lazy, but say it were an absolute bluff, like a total cliff. If I had to cross the trail, how much time would you rest it after that happens? Like, cause this is the rut, everything's crazy right now. Like, can you get away with, do you think, crossing over a deer trail and just planning on shooting that spot, or maybe looping down from where you think they're going to be coming so that they don't cross it right in your shooting window? Or
definitely different approaches. And honestly, my thought process on it is that I'm just going to try to cross that thing where I feel like they're going to give me a bow shot. So like, hopefully, obviously anything can happen when they catch that ground scent and they might just split right out of there. But hopefully when they, if that comes to be the case and they hit that ground scent, they kind of stop and freeze up. And then that gives you your shot opportunity. So that's my thought process on it. But I think the looping method or any other type of way to do it works. I've just always thought about it like, hey, if they do catch that ground scent, hopefully it's the buck I want to shoot. He stops, gives me an opportunity, and then it's over. But
sure.
Obviously, it, just like everything else, like I said, it's always situational, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. No, that's very interesting. I like that approach a lot. I want to talk to you a little bit about, so we're recording this on November 3rd, like I mentioned. This is going to come out next week on the 11th.
Mm-hmm.
This mid-November time frame is, I mean, people say, you know, peak rut. There's a lot of, you know, I guess peak breeding, I should say. And, you know, yeah, it can be crazy. But I think, I don't know. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong. Maybe it's just the way that the properties that I've hunted tend to be. But it seems like that late October, first week of November time frame, or maybe even like first like 4 days, 5 days of November on my properties is when the bucks are really kind of frenzied. It's like somebody kicked the hornet's nest and there's just a lot of action. My mid-November hunts have been much more slow, kind of just like a trickle of deer activity. I see a lot of big mature bucks and stuff, but they're fewer and further between. I'm not seeing that parade of deer activity like I normally do. So this is like, you know, the time of year where just kind of sticking your butt in the stand and grinding it out can oftentimes be the best strategy, right?
Yes.
When it comes to getting mobile and scouting around, you know, obviously be doing it within reason, you know, if it's on public land versus private land, very different situations in terms of alerting the deer to your presence. But what types of sign are you keying in on right now?
Yeah. So if we're looking at the time frame of when this thing's starting to come out, honestly, the types of, if I'm looking for any type of sign to set up on, I'm usually kind of transitioning back into at least paying some attention to those primary scrapes. I guess like a favorite tactic of mine that time of the year is looking for that primary scrape that might have been really active, like the end of October, getting a lot of buck activity when they first started looking for does. Because my hope when I'm at a setup like that is to catch a buck that either lost track of a doe that he was following or just maybe missed out on an opportunity at another doe and now he's back on the search. I find that those scrapes, those primary ones, are going to be check-in points as they're trying to get back on track. And that is particularly useful if it's after some type of a rain and those scrapes are more susceptible to being freshened up. Like, that's a tactic that I really like to go after. But again, it's got to be that primary scrape. And usually I'm only setting up in a setup like that if I feel like they are condensed travel wise to hit that scrape and not be able to work on the downwind side of it. So a lot of the times I'm transitioning into targeting things like a drainage top where it's really steep. It doesn't make sense for them to go down and back up to scent check it. They'll just hit that scrape itself. And those are going to be what I really like to target from a sign perspective in this phase of the rut.
Interesting, dude. That was a perfect segue into, so I guess, well, before we move on to there, primary scrapes, like you said, like the big ones that have been opened up earlier in the year that are still working. Do you pay any attention to, I mean, you know, sometimes bucks just, they have a doe nearby or there's another buck and then they get all antsy and they start just opening up a new scrape and stuff like that. So you can be walking through the woods and see a bottom or a ridge top or whatever it may be, just riddled with a bunch of, you know, like dinner plate size scrapes.
Yep.
Even if they're fresh, do you pay any attention to those? Like, does freshness play into it? Like, if there's still, you know, a wet spot in it, will you key in on that? Or
that's a really good thought. And definitely I do. And I think that a really good example of actually seeing how that all plays out. So like you can actually picture what is going on when you see that type of sign around maybe one of these primary scrapes. Is so I have the primary scrape where I shot an arrow at that buck that I was talking about on my property. And if you mm-hmm. were to walk around that, you would see a bunch of those smaller scrapes. And when that happened was there was a different buck that I saw that night that was following a doe, and he was rubbing trees. He was making scrapes. He was just like sticking behind that doe, and the walk that he was on didn't make sense. It was just kind of like zigzagging over, and he would stop every 25 yards or so and either rub a tree or make a scrape. So then it's like, if you remove yourself from that situation and you just find something like that scouting, it's like, okay, you can now paint that scene of what actually happened here. So I'm looking at that area, something like that, as like what can be a rut zone. Clearly there is some type of rutting activity here, something like I just mm-hmm. laid out. So there's a chance that that same rutting activity is going to come back through here, because if that was a hot doe, which in this case I know that it was, what's stopping another buck from coming through there searching for her? So those smaller scrapes when they're surrounding the primary one can definitely be something that I'm targeting. But if it's just those smaller scrapes, I'm usually not putting much weight to it, because a buck can randomly be chasing a doe for a long time and hit a spot on a ridge and never come back there again. But those primaries are usually focused around where the terrain condenses activity. So that at least gets me in the zone to be able to set up on these deer.
Mm-hmm. Got it. That makes perfect sense, man. I'd never thought of it that. I guess I haven't seen many bucks actually open up a scrape. Just haven't been in those positions, but
yeah,
that's fascinating that that's what they're doing there. And interesting too, on like the rut standpoint, or excuse me, not the rut, the rub standpoint, like, is that generally, cause like we think early season rubs, you can follow that rub line back to their bedding and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Finding fresh rubs now, it's more so just, they probably had a doe in that area and they were just fired up. Is that
maybe they've gotten done fighting with another buck, or they know another buck is by the doe and they're just really aggravated. I think that there's a lot more randomness to those rubs right now, but mm-hmm. I just look at it like I associate it just with rut activity. Like there was something rutty going on around here. And then I'm just asking myself, okay, is this somewhere that travel is condensed? Because if that rut activity comes back and I'm here, then I'm going to have a good chance to get them in bow range. And that's why I don't give much weight to those places. They're on the open ridges or just not anywhere that really pinches movement, because you might get rut activity that comes back through there, but are you going to be able to set up on it in bow range? And if I'm not, then I'm, or if I don't have good odds, at least I'm not going to waste my time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. So that the main thing with both any of, whether it be the primary scrapes, the smaller scrapes near the primary scrape or a rub, is if you are going to hunt sign right now, it's got to be fresh, right?
Yeah, it's got to be fresh sign, and it's got to be somewhere that is pinching down movement. You know, like if I have a primary scrape, and I mean, even if I'm 100, 150 yards away from it on a travel pinch point leading to it, then I'm completely fine hunting that pinch point. I want to be close to the hot sign, but also somewhere that's going to bring these deer into bow range.
Mm-hmm. Got it. That's a great tip there, that setting up. Not necessarily, doesn't have to be on that, you know, if it is a travel scrape, but focusing on whatever pinch point or funnel, correct, is, you know, adjacent to it. That's super smart. Cause I feel like a lot of guys, I don't know, myself included, like, we see that scrape, we find that scrape, it's all ripped up and like, my setup kind of sucks. But then like, you know, or we have that deer loop down around the scrape. Whereas like, like you said, if you can get to that pinch point where it's, they don't have an option. That's great, man. So you mentioned drainage tops. Are there any other types of like features that you key in on like right now, like specifically for mid-November?
Excuse me. Another one that I like is out on like the more long and open ridge points. Sometimes I'll find scrapes out on the end of those. Now, these aren't going to be the points that we're looking at from a bedding perspective, kind of like what you're talking about earlier with the rub lines. And I don't know if these exist everywhere. I know that we have them all over the place here in Southern Ohio, but when we have these long and narrow points, anytime that you have food down in the bottom and then bedding cover up on top of the ridge, those long, narrow points where it's very steep on the sides, that is the easiest way for those bucks to get from the lower to the upper. And then anytime you're in between doe areas like that, food and bedding, that little transition area can be somewhere that those bucks move through. And then if you have a point that has a scrape on it, kind of like we were talking about, if you get a buck that lost track of a doe or is just moving from one doe area to the next, then those scrapes can be good spots for those bucks to stop on those long and narrow points. You know, any point can be good, but I'm about stacking my odds, you know, stacking my odds the best that I can. So if I'm in a pinch point between bedding and food, good. But if that pinch point also has a scrape, even better, because now there's one more reason for that buck to visit me at that pinch point.
You saw the game-winning play once, but have to replay it 3 times on the way back to the hotel, because some moments don't end at the buzzer. Life's a trip. Make the most of it at Best Western. Book direct and save at bestwestern.com.
How many discounts does USAA Auto Insurance offer? Too many to say here. Multi-vehicle discount, safe driver discount, new vehicle discount, storage discount, legacy.
How many discounts will you stack up? Tap the banner or visit usaa.com/autodiscounts. Restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Peloton. Break through the busiest time of year with the brand new Peloton Cross Training Tread Plus. Powered by Peloton IQ. With real-time guidance and endless ways to move, you can personalize your workouts and train with confidence, helping you reach your goals in less time. Let yourself run, lift, sculpt, push, and go. Explore the new Peloton Cross Training Tread Plus at onepeloton.com.
President's Day savings are happening now at the Home Depot with up to 40% off select appliances. Looking to upgrade your fridge? Check out LG's newest model, serving up ice in all kinds of styles. Cube, crushed, craft ice, and now new mini craft ice straight from the dispenser. From cold brew to fizzy favorites, these refrigerators will have you entertaining like a pro. Shop President's Day savings and get up to 40% off, plus free delivery on select appliances like LG at the Home Depot. Free delivery on appliance purchases of $1,498 or more. Offer valid February 5th through the 25th. U.S. only. See store online for details.
What if it's like a big, like a creek bottom system? You've still got longer points and they drop down into that creek bottom. Not necessarily food, but maybe they drop down in there for, I mean, obviously hub scrapes and stuff are down there.
Yeah, definitely.
Or there could be food up on two tops. Are they doing the same thing there?
Yeah, same type of thing. As long as there's a point of interest below and above. That's the key.
Okay.
You just got to make sure they have a reason from go to point A to point B. Because if you're missing one of those, the movement in between that point is just going to be much more random.
Got it. That makes perfect sense. How wide of a point are you talking about? Like when you say narrow, what do you look for?
Yeah, like the actual top where it's like flat enough. I mean, I would say they range in like the 50-ish yard range, like wide.
Yeah.
It's just kind of gradual before a very steep drop off. But we see those a lot down here in Southern Ohio.
Yeah, especially over by where I'm at in the Driftless region. Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've been over there handful of times. I've got my butt kicked out there, but I know similar type of terrain.
Yeah, it's really, really good at kicking your butt. Yeah,
yeah, for sure. I've noticed that. I've gotten humbled out there more times than once.
Yep. Hey guys, I just wanted to take a quick sec to tell you about Lone Wolf Custom Gear. Lone Wolf Custom Gear is as good as it gets when it comes to mobile hunting equipment. Whether you're a saddle or stand guy, public land or private, Lone Wolf Custom Gear has a set of sticks, a stand, a camera arm, and any number of accessories to get you closer to your target buck. To make it even better, everything is 100% USA sourced and made right here in the Midwest. And it's even assembled right across the river in Iowa by hunters who love chasing deer just as much as you do. To build your kit today, go visit lonewolfcustomgear.com. Now, let's get back to the episode. On the note of like, I just thought of this. So I scouted a new piece of public a couple weeks ago. And, you know, my wheels are spinning right now, just in terms of how I broke it down. Do you tend to see those longer ridges, like the longer, narrower kind of points, or I guess the fingers that drop down into the bottom? Do those tend to be, at least, so the property that I'm thinking of here, it seemed like the longer the ridge, the more open it tended to be. Mm-hmm. But those little knobs and little bumps, not really drainages, but like, you know, how like a drainage, you know, usually has like two or three little cuts that form the actual main thing. Mm-hmm. And it was in those little tiny, I don't know what the proper, I mean, you're the terrain expert here. What do you call those? Like when it is just like a little tiny finger or like a knob that drops off.
I just still call them a point. It's just like I'm looking
differently
than the long and narrow one. I'm just looking at that as like a bedding point, and then one of these long and narrow ones is like a travel point, basically.
Got it. Yep. That was my that was exactly what my question was. It's like, are those shorter points, do they tend to be
that's what
specifically
I
for, all for bedding, and then the bigger ones are more for travel?
Yeah, and then if I am going to hunt like in a bottom of like a hub system during the rut, it's going to be in something like that that has a few of those potential bedding points, because hopefully a buck is bedded on one of those points kind of overlooking the hub system, and he's waiting for does to come through there. And hopefully one does, or if you do some calling, like the other morning, I was able to call two bucks down into a bottom that were what I believe, because they're on the leeward side where the wind was coming over their back up on that point. And then there's a big scrape down in the bottom. And I called in about 9:30. They came right off the ridge. And I think they're just curious as to what was going on down there, because it was thick. They couldn't see, but they heard activity. So, well, let's go down there and check it out and see what's going on. So that's kind of a scenario where I'll target those types of hubs, is when there are bedding points all around.
Sure. Yeah. Is there, what's the time window in the, like the time of day, I guess, for hunting a hub during the rut?
Yeah. Like, that's, do you try and, because, I've not really been a huge fan of hunting these because they're so finicky with the wind and everything, but this year on our rut hunts, I got a couple buddies in town, we're all hunting, we're just seeing the majority of the deer activity in the bottom, so it is what it is. We're going in there and we're hunting them. I find that it's really going to depend on like the orientation of that drainage. If it's facing the south and it's going to get sun earlier, you're going to start to get those thermals pulling up once that ground starts warming up, and then you're going to get swirly winds a lot sooner, as if you're on the north side of a steep ridge and you're down in that bottom. It's going to get a good thermal pull down for a while before it heats up, or before the ground starts to heat up. So I've been only hunting them on the south side until like, I guess around 10 o'clock, but like I was able to get in the one on the north side of the ridge today until 11 o'clock before everything started pulling up. And I just feel like when things are pulling up, I might get something that's just not paying attention, but there's a good chance that before that buck even gets down towards that hub, he's going to have an idea and not even come down there.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Just checking those point, basically walking those drainage tops, catching everything coming up and then checking it that way.
Exactly.
Got it. Got it. So drainage tops and those long skinny points, long, narrow.
Those right now.
Gotcha. Are you setting up when you're on those narrow points? Are you shooting for, if there's like a bench or like kind of like a little flatter spot that things.
So really I'm setting up right. For me, that's just a scrape hunt. I'm just trying to hunt. Scrape activity. If I can get within bow range of that scrape, then that's ideal for me. Cause then I'm going to catch that movement as it crests the hill coming up to that scrape. And I think that you can get away with some calling there too, because the activity should be coming from the bottom. You know, it's the rut, so anything can happen, but they should be coming from down below and they can't really see. So if you do some kind of light calling and like I face away from the lower elevation, so it kind of sounds like it's up the point, you can get them to commit to come up over top, and you can then just get them right on that scrape.
Got it. Makes sense. What type of calling do you tend to do this time of year?
I do some grunt calling. I have the can call, and then I just do some rattling, just kind of mix all of them in there. And I don't get like too aggressive with the types of the calls. It's just like real basic contact grunts, some doe bleats every now and again, and then a light rattling session. But my frequency is pretty high. Especially when I'm on public land, because it's like, you don't really know when the deer are coming through. And if I do spook a deer with calling, I mean, I might call one in 20 minutes later. So I don't get concerned about my frequency when I'm out on my public land hunts. I like to make some noise out there.
Mm-hmm. Got it. That makes sense. How does that change on private? Are you mostly just going off what you know?
I mean, on private. So like with my property, for example, because that's the one that I know the best right now, I have a pretty good idea on how the deer are spending time on there. And if I am going to be hunting out there for longer stretches, I might call. I'm definitely going to be more conservative in general, but I might call. But when I'm getting close to the time that I know the deer are usually in that part of my property, I'll start to pick up the frequency a little bit, because like that spot we were talking about earlier, I can see deer from 80 to 100 yards away. And sometimes they just browse on acorns and don't come down to the point. So I can't see everything up where they're eating those acorns 80 to 100 yards away. So when I know that they might be over there, I'm going to pull the calls out and maybe I'll be able to get one curious enough to drop down a little bit to me.
Gotcha. Got it. Totally makes sense. A couple of things that we haven't touched on in terms of like, you know, the classic rut funnels and stuff like that are like saddles. I guess we don't really have as many. Well, let's start with the saddle here. Is there a reason that you didn't mention a saddle in this conversation for this time of year?
I guess the only reason I didn't mention it first was because the last two features I talked about are my recent hunts. So those were fresh on my mind.
I like it.
I still do like to target saddles, but and it's like the same kind of idea where I only want to get into a saddle that has doe activity on both sides of it. You know, if there's doe activity on one, that's good, but I really only want to target the ones that have it on both. So ideally a saddle that is in between two logging cuts, like that's where I'm going to go. Now, the tricky part is with saddles is that out of any of the features, they're the easiest to read on a topo map. It's one of the first features that I feel like people learn how to actually read on a map. So it's noticeable and there's a lot of hunter activity when you're on public land. So the key is to find the saddle first that is in between the doe areas, but two, is it going to have that pressure or not? And if I can find one that's unpressured, then I'm definitely comfortable going in there. But generally for me, when I'm first going into an area, like if I'm on a new rut hunt and I'm going to go and look at the saddles first, if I've never been into that property before, because that's the easiest place I feel like when there's doe activity on both sides to see bucks. And that's the kind of place that I'm comfortable hunting all day long. Like those are usually my all day sits is in a saddle because they can rip through there at any time.
Okay. Got it. That makes sense. Mm-hmm. What are you looking at more so than, so if that's your all day sit, if you're moving around throughout a day during the rut, what are you moving? What are you starting with and then moving to? And at what time are you trying to make that switch?
Yeah, that's a great question. So like an example of how I would stack up a day would be like hunt a point scrape in the morning. And then once I kind of probably like middle of the day ish, like 11:30, I'll start to get down. And then I would work my way over to a drainage top where then I can kind of loop down the ridge and then circle back up the drainage and then get that evening thermal pull right down that drainage. So that's a good little combo if I do want to move, but sometimes the moves are not that much. Like if I'm not hunting maybe a terrain funnel, but I'm hunting a habitat edge, like just a break, like a logging cut to mature timber, and I see that there's been consistent activity a couple hundred yards away from me, I'll tear my stuff down and I'll just move up to that because clearly there's something that's putting the deer here and not in front of me. So it can be a micro move too. And that's usually more so like when I'm hunting thickets, like logging cuts or bedding thickets in farm country, that's when I'm making those smaller moves.
Okay. Got it. That makes sense. So it's in the mornings, you're kind of, or I guess mornings or evenings, you're kind of hunting that almost like the elevation transition areas, right? Where they're going from top to bottom.
Yep.
For lack of a better term.
It really and then comes down to, you know, like, where am I anticipating these does to be at? Because the does rule all for me during the rut. If I can be around where those does are at or are going to be, like that's why I like those point setups, is because I know those does are coming back to the bedding. You know, the bucks are the ones that are searching for the does most of the time, but those does want to come back to that bedding. So the bucks know that as well. So they're going to transition up to those bedding areas where the does are going to be late morning. And that's why that's a good morning spot, because they're leaving the food where the does were at night and coming back to the bedding where the does are during the daytime. And I'm just trying to put myself where I'm anticipating the movement to be.
For sure. Makes sense. Do you pay any attention to like, or I guess put any weight into like a field edge scrape or anything like that this time of year?
I mean, I definitely can, more so like on, that's going to be on like private ground though.
Sure.
Right. I find that like, man, if you can find a scrape on public land and it wasn't that hard for you to find it, then I'm probably not going to hunt around that. I've been through that enough times to know that that's just not a good idea. Got to find the one where it's like you stumble across it in the thick cover, or it's tucked away from an access point. That's usually, it's just like, because I always go back to, what are my odds of seeing something here? Can you see a buck on that first scrape that was easy to find? Absolutely. Anything can happen when you're hunting, but it's probably not going to happen. So I'm going to look elsewhere. But now those large scrapes, I mean, one on my property is a really good example. That sits in the middle of wide open mature timber. But the reason that one's so good is because once that scrape was like opened up and started by me back in the beginning of September, nobody went back there again until Halloween night. So that's right. Why that one's good, but that doesn't happen on public land.
Mm-hmm. How have you seen the deer respond since you hunted that scrape?
So, and this is a little bit of a different scenario, I feel like, because after I shot that buck and I saw blood on the arrow, like I had to confirm that I didn't kill him. You know, I had to make sure I followed the blood trail. And then I got the shot on video. I know I sent that to you on my trail camera, so I get to relive that heartbreak. But after reviewing all that, I at least had to go and make sure that this wasn't going to be a lethal shot. So with that, I walked into more of the core part of my property, and the activity since then has been extremely slow. But again, like, I know they work on a cycle. I think all I did is shorten up the time they spent on my property, but they should be back here probably today or tomorrow. I'd expect them to kind of roll back into the area.
Got it. Got it. So a few days, you know, handful of days, right?
Yeah. Gotcha. And I'm sure they're around. It's just, I don't get great cell signal on my property, so I can only put cell cameras in a couple spots. But I'm sure I'm picking them up on the non-cell cameras right now.
Right, for sure. If you're hunting public land right now, how would you use cell cameras? Like, say you're running and gunning, you're out of state, or you're coming to Wisconsin, or you're going to Minnesota or wherever.
That's a great question. I can tell you that one of the strategies that would be successful, that could have been successful for my friends and I last year, we have this nice saddle actually out in Wisconsin that we always run a trail camera on. And what we've noticed since we've ran the trail camera on the saddle is that once a good buck cruises through it, if you can plan a trip out to Wisconsin, because for the next 4 or 5 days, there's going to be a lot of activity there. So I think it's going to change from one area to the next, but like, we just picked up on that there's consistent activity once you see the first one come through. And ideally, if you can find some spots like that out on public land where you know, then you can have your cameras kind of out and up and ready. And then once that activity starts, it's like, okay, is there something going on over here? Or was that just a random occurrence? But ideally, if you see some rutting activity, then I'm probably going to go in there and make it happen. But that's why I really like to run my cameras, whether it's cell or non-cell, on video mode, because the amount of intel you get from videos compared to pictures is second to none.
Yeah, definitely. Well, for sure. You can see kind of the demeanor of the deer. You can see which way they came from. You can hear those grunts if that buck's fired up and hot on that doe's tail. Yeah, because I know
that there's been, before I did video mode, and now that I see the videos, like, I know that there was times where does came through and you just got a picture of the doe, but you didn't get the 20-second clip of that buck following behind her.
Yep. Yeah, definitely. I that's something that, I don't even want to know how many bucks I've probably missed just this year even. But I like that strategy of, you know, once that first one shows up in an area, buckle up, because it's probably going to be worth spending some time in there. Definitely. I just had a total brain fart. Oh, that's what it was. So that's obviously in hill country. Do you see or hear folks have similar experiences in like wetlands or like bottoms and, you know, marshy areas or stuff that's just flatter in general?
I mean, I think that with those types of habitats, you're working a lot more with edges than you are with the terrain. And I think that as long as you're focusing around those edges and anything where a lot of stuff converges together, I think you're going to see the same type of experience. So like when I'm working on properties in farm country, the same way that I'm trying to combine like a drainage top with a saddle and look for a good funnel and build around that, you can do the same thing if you have a creek that connects to a brushy field that connects to a food source. You know, if you can just find those hubs of activity and build around it or just set up around it if you're hunting in a public land scenario, then those are going to be the places you have the same type of success.
Sure. Makes sense. I want to stick with the flat-ish, or maybe it's just like a rolling hills farm country. Stay on that note for just a moment there. A lot of times guys are driving a truck through a picked field to get to their stand, or the best access to a stand is, you know, walking through a field and stuff like that, or just trying not to blow up a property. Any advice on figuring out how to do so without alerting the deer to your presence from 400 yards away?
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely tough. I mean, the long-term solution, if you're talking about doing this on a property that you own and manage, is by implementing screen cover. So that way you have that visual block that gets you into these pinch points. That's going to be your best way. But when you don't have that ability, honestly, the amount of disturbance that you would put on the property going through that open field compared to if you tried to secure yourself walking where the cover was, you're probably going to do more harm than good in the long run. So you might as well just come across the field, get in that spot, get set up, and then just ride it out. Because that's how I do my farm country hunts anyway. I like to just get in there before daylight, try to get into that tight area without a flashlight when possible, get set up, and then just ride it out for the day. So that way, even if you do bump something right away, there's a good chance that you're going to have completely different deer coming and funneling through at a few hours down the road.
For sure. How early are you trying to get in?
I'd like to, if I'm settled in, you know, a half an hour before shooting light on my all day sits, I try not to get too crazy just because all day sits can really grind on you. I try to just do a half hour beforehand, just enough where I can kind of start to see, but it's not like pitch black out.
Sure. Yeah, totally makes sense. Yeah, it always makes it easier too when you make that, like trying to get the last, you know, 40, 50 yards into there. You can see where you're stepping and you can
better check than your straps. Noise and having your flashlights all over the place.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's been like one of my biggest hiccups this year has been trying to figure out, like, okay, am I getting in here too early and I'm just making a ton of noise and blowing the place out just through making noise rather than visual stuff? Or is it, but like, would I be better to, I guess, let me ask, like, so it sounds like you're not necessarily fully anti, but if you can leave a flashlight off, you're going to leave it off. If you're near a road or if you're near a farm or something like that, where there's like maybe structures that have lights on them, are you okay with like clicking one on, clicking one off real quick? And like,
oh yeah,
just so you can get over a thing? Or
yeah, I definitely do that even when I'm trying not to use my flashlight. Like if I have to put it on quick, I just make sure like I know what I'm using it for. I'm not just like blindly just swinging it around. And really it's just from an impact perspective why I do that, just trying to keep it as natural as possible out there. Because what I feel like is when you can walk in without that flashlight around that time, even if you're making a lot of noise, like if you ever heard like turkeys, a porcupine, a raccoon walk through the woods, like they don't do it quietly, but they're also not shining a light. So just because a deer might be bedded up on a ridge, and if I'm making a lot of noise walking, I mean, as long as it's not like metal clinking or Velcro ripping or anything like that, as far as they're concerned, that's just another animal lunking his way through the woods.
For sure. Yeah, dude, that's such a good point on making sure that your gear is silent and that it is do you try and walk in any sort of like a cadence or like mix in any pauses or anything like that?
Yeah, sound like visualize like whatever it is. Obviously, I'm not going to like go to the big extents to try to make sure I sound just like a porcupine or something, but like
right.
I just watch things when you see them from a tree stand walk through the woods, and usually it's very rarely animals just like consistently walking. They're usually walking like 20, 30 yards, stopping and smelling something, eating something, whatever. So I'll just walk 20, 30 yards, kind of look around, walk another 20, 30 yards, look around, and then just do it nice and easy and not be in any rush, and then just kind of slowly work your way through.
For sure. Yeah, dude, that's such a good point. Yeah, that's one that I have been not doing properly this year. Sometimes it's like, well, it's like you start getting the panic before first light. We're like, well, I got to get to the tree at this point. The deer are going to start moving. I'm going to get run over here if I don't go. And then it's like, and it's like, well, okay, now they definitely know that that wasn't a raccoon or whatever. But yeah, that's tough, man. I don't know. I've started to become more of a almost more of like, I know it's risky, but like almost more of a gray light entry kind of guy this year, just because I know I can do it silently. And
yeah,
a lot of my spots are, you know, if I'm trying to get close to bedding, I'm presuming that I'm getting in there hopefully just before those deer are. So
yeah, it's definitely for me at this time of the year, I don't mind at all getting in gray light. Really the only time, like when I'm going to hunt in the morning, if I'm getting, when I want to get in there really early, that's if I'm hunting like a specific bed or a specific buck going back to a specific bed, something like that. That's the only time. And at that point, I'm getting out there early enough that he really shouldn't be anywhere close to that setup. And then I'm fine using the flashlight because he should be feeding a distance away from there.
Right. Right. Yeah. A couple hundred yards where there's no way he's going to see it. Yeah.
Right. Yep.
Gotcha. Yeah, that makes sense. Dude, that's such a good distinction too. Yeah, just the, I guess the quote on like, you know, the rules that we have throughout a deer season about like, mm-hmm. well, when you need to get in at this point or you need to do this or not that, and this, here's how you need to access and how that changes throughout the season. Like,
yep.
Not that in the rut's going to really have that big of an impact, but like right. you said, like you get in there at 4 a.m. on a full day or on all day sit, like you're going to be hurting by
good
the end of it. Like,
yeah, good luck making it all day.
Right. So when it comes to planning access for some of these spots, like on that note there, mm-hmm. In the morning, trying to access from the bottom whenever possible. If not, you know, you have to access from the top. Will you hold off on on accessing a spot if you think that, like, if that's a major food source or something like that, or will you try and bump them with the truck or anything? Or I guess, is there anything that you can do when going into the morning, like wait for them to trickle out of the field and get back into the timber? Cause then you're kind of missing them. Like,
right.
How do you balance that?
It really depends on the scenario, because I mean, I will access from the tops in the mornings, and that's like that ridge point example that I was talking about with the scrape, you know, okay. When I know they're feeding down below and bedding up top. If I come in the early part of the morning, even around that gray light, they should be making that transition. And since you have just the flat, narrow walk down the top there, you can just go right in and then you should be set up before they're starting to make their way up. And really the way that I'm focusing my access is, how can I get into these locations where the deer shouldn't be at right now? Now, I know that this can be not obvious when you're just out there in the middle of the day in big timber hill country, because like, well, the deer can be anywhere, and that's right. So I'm not as worried about it. If I'm making like a midday adjustment, I'm just really focused on getting to my spot, you know, making sure that my setup is right and dialed in, because again, the deer you spook, the deer you bump could be a completely different group of deer in another 2.5 hours that just kind of get like that rut flow that comes through your area. So it's definitely situational, but the biggest thing I'm trying to keep in mind is when I'm trying to be more sneaky with my access, is do so in a way that you're coming in from where the deer shouldn't be at.
Right. Makes sense, dude. Yeah. That's definitely easier said than done. Is there any advice, I guess, for figuring out, like if they're on a new property, similar to like what you have, like figuring out when the right time is to access that? Like, do you recommend folks like shine their fields at night, like just so they kind of know, like, okay, our deer.
Yeah. Whatever you have to do to learn it. And that's just really where like the idea of woodsmanship comes in for me. It's just starting to understand whether it is a piece of public ground or a piece of private ground you're managing, just understanding how the animals are using your property. And for deer, that's really simple, because the two main things where they spend most of their time are bedding and feeding. So you only have two things to decipher, and you know that they like to bed in areas with higher stem count, low cover. That's probably going to be the bedding. And then the food source, that's going to change depending on where you're hunting and everything. You know, they can feed in the timber, they can feed in food plots, cornfields, whatever that may be. But find out where those two places are, whether they're both on your property or one is on and one is off, and then just plan your access routes accordingly, knowing that throughout the night, the deer are generally feeding, and throughout the day, they're generally bedding. So that's how I like to structure, and I think that's how somebody could build an approach around their access.
Sure. Got it. Makes sense. Son of a gun, dude. I had a really good question. Dang it. I got rut brain right now.
Rut brain. I was just going to say that. You get the good ideas and then they slip.
Yep, exactly. Oh, dang it. It was about terrain or not terrain. It was about, I don't know, man. Gone. maybe it'll come back. We'll see.
Yeah.
But dude, we're coming up on an hour here. It's the, you know, peak of the rut. So I want to make sure you got time to, you know, rest up a little bit and, you know, get time to get up back in the stand for the afternoon sit. But we've covered a bunch of different stuff here today. If you had three pieces of advice that you could leave folks with for hunting the middle of November here, our gun season opens on the 22nd. So we've got, from the time this comes out, we've got 11 days. Guys are still running around with the buck tag in their pocket. What's your advice for them?
I think one, find out where the hot sign is and hunt around that hot sign. I think that's going to be the starting point. That's going to at least put you in the right area. I think two is going to be to give yourself as much stand time as possible. I think that during this time of the year, it's truly when things get very random and anything can happen at any time. Like I said, you know, if a buck is locked down with a doe, that's going to be very hard to hunt that buck. But some bucks are going to get pushed off of does. Some bucks are just going to be seeking for that next doe, and that can just happen at any time of the year. So those are the first two. If I could think of the third one, I guess that it would just be to enjoy the grind. You know, if you still got a buck tag in your pocket, you've probably already had some pretty long days in the tree. Maybe you've missed opportunity like I've had, but I think it's, you got to just stay positive because it can change in a moment. You can get redemption. You can get your first opportunity if you haven't had one in the blink of an eye. So I think that just find the right spot, hunt it, and be confident because it's, the opportunity should come if you just keep grinding it out.
I love it, man. Yeah. I remembered my question.
Right.
It's on the note of multiple sits. How many sits will you give a stand versus resting one during the rut?
That's another really good question. If you know the property.
Depends.
Yeah, it obviously depends. If you know the property well, then kind of hunt it accordingly, like what I mentioned about my property and the way that the deer kind of cycle through it. But, and then it, again, wherever it is that you're hunting, I think that, like, I have some rut zones, what I call them, in my farm country areas that I hunt, that I feel like you can just go in there and hunt them. And there's so many deer in that area that a different buck could come through at any time. And then when it comes to the hill country thing, if I find the right pinch point and I feel like there should be deer there, I'm still not afraid to re-hunt that spot again, because especially if I'm doing all day sits, if I'm in a rut funnel and there's no activity there, I think that the next day, you know, you're just one day closer to that being the rut zone, and you can stack those sits on top of each other. So I don't feel like you have to be a one and done type of thing during the rut. I think you're okay just because the deer are traveling more.
Mm-hmm. Got it. Makes sense. I like that. That, yeah, every day that it doesn't happen, you're one day closer to that being
good,
the spot.
It's a good frame of mind that I use right now to try to stay locked into the hunt. Like, the scrape I was hunting this morning looked like it hadn't been hit in like 4 or 5 days. So it's like, well, today could be the day that they come back, because sooner or later they're going to come back. But it wasn't it. But at least I was locked in and engaged on the activity and visualizing how they'd come to that scrape.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Let me ask you this. So say in hill country, we can have a bunch of swirly winds and stuff like that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Thermals, your wind can be, I mean, doing 180 from when you get into the stand to when you're, you know, the middle of the day, right? Depending on what your thermals are doing. If you get busted in a stand, will that influence how willing you are to resit it, or will you try and rest one? Like, if I got busted this morning, like I did hunting this stand, but then didn't get busted the rest of the day, or will you, or I guess not even, yeah. Like, will you re-hunt that area like tomorrow morning if the conditions allow?
I think if the conditions are right and it's not like some crazy bump, then yeah, definitely. Now, like my property, for example, went out and tried to track that deer for a little bit, and it feels like I just kind of like really pushed the deer away from the core part of my property. So I'm just giving that some time, you know. I'm on a stretch right now where I'm hunting, and then I'm going to be coming, if I don't fill my tag the next couple days, I'm going to take 3 or 4 days out of Ohio, come back in, and then hunt for another window. And during that second window is when I'll go back out and try to have another go at my property. So again, you know, you go back to the whole situational, depends type of a mindset with it. But I think that there are times and places that even if you do a bump and it feels like it's the spot, just trust your gut. And if you feel like you got to go in there, then just do it and make it happen. And if it doesn't work out, like, I mean, well, you just, the cool thing is you get to go and get, try again tomorrow. So,
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's the thing too, is, you know, if you're fortunate like we are and you get to link multiple sits, multiple mornings in a row, you know, it's a lot nicer because then
definitely
it is, but it isn't. So it's right. Like, so I guess I've got a two prong question here before we wrap this up. If you are hunting consecutive days and you can't make it happen, but your scent is left in there, you know that like the deer know that at least that like you're hunting them, what are you giving them for a break? Sounds like that 3 day ish range.
Yeah, I would say that's a pretty good guideline. And unless, of course, you know, like, cause that's an area I got my cell camera. If I got a notification and it's like, oh, he's back, it's like, well, I'm going to go there right now, you know, and do my thing. But yeah, I guess like a 3 day guideline would be pretty good.
Okay. I like that. Yeah. I like that a lot. And then the second prong of that question for the guy who's only getting out there, he's the weekend warrior, only has time to get out, you know, 2 or 3 days a week. Or 1 to 3 days a week, whatever, maybe it's just an afternoon. They're pretty safe to just send it.
I would, get in the right spot. Yeah, definitely. Now's the time to send it and just make it happen. But the best you can, just do what you can.
Definitely. I love it, man. Well, dude, this has been eye-opening for me. I know what I need to do, for the next, 10 days or so here before a gun opens. But dude, you've got some fantastic social media content that you put out there. It's why I wanted to have you on. It's just your reels and your YouTube content. You do an excellent job at making it easy for Neanderthals like myself to visualize, like, oh, this is what's actually going on in this type of terrain, or how I need to access and why. Where can folks go to get in touch with you, follow along with your season, and learn more about Next Level Whitetail?
Yeah, so Instagram page is just Greg, G-R-E-G underscore Next Level Whitetail. And like you said, I post a lot of just like quick educational type of content on there. And then I have a YouTube channel that's just Next Level Whitetail. And I'm actually right in the middle. By the time this comes out, the whole series will be out. I'm just doing like this mini series of a lot of the terrain features that we talked about today, breaking down individual stand locations and how I would hunt them and why I would hunt them during the rut. So when this does come out, if you still have a tag, that's a quick little series. Videos are about 4 or 5 minutes long, and they'll give you some just tactical advice of how you can hunt hill country in the rut.
Awesome. Yeah, I'll be sure to link those in the show notes then.
Awesome.
Give people a nice reference point. That'll be great. But perfect. Dude, I learned a ton today. I can't thank you enough for taking time out of your rutcation to hop on and shoot the breeze with me, dude. Good luck in the, well, this evening, but if not this evening, in the next coming days, like you said, if it doesn't happen today, we're just one day closer. But man, this has been an absolute pleasure. So good luck to you. And hey, hopefully we see a grip and grin soon.
That sounds good, man. Thank you.
That's all for this week's episode. Thank you so much for tuning in. If you like this episode, be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. And while you're at it, if you could leave me a 5-star review, I would appreciate that a ton. You can also follow along with my outdoor adventures on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube at The Wisconsin Sportsman. That's also the best way to get a hold of me to suggest topics, guests, or questions you'd like me to explore on this show. Big thanks to our awesome partners, Lone Wolf Custom Gear, Onyx Hunt, Huntworth Gear, Good Chance Fly Fishing, and the Wisconsin chapter of Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. Please go support the brands that support this show. And if you're looking for more awesome outdoor content, go check out thesportsmansempire.com, where you'll find a ton of other awesome outdoor podcasts. And until next time, make sure you make the time to get outside and enjoy the incredible natural resources that are ours as Wisconsin sportsmen.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.